This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. North Carolina is now in the red zone for COVID-19 cases. That's according to standards set by the White House Coronavirus Task Force. Yesterday, the Department of Health and Human Services recorded the highest one-day case count since the pandemic began, and hospitalizations are again on the rise. And as we gear up for colder weather and big family holidays, our coronavirus trends are heading in the wrong direction. Lisa Grilinski joins me now to look at the numbers and help us make sense of this moment. She's an assistant professor in the Department of Epidemiology at UNC Chapel Hill. Lisa, welcome back.
Thank you so much for having me.
What do you make of these latest numbers in North Carolina?
They're really worrisome, and they're really bad, honestly. You know, even while the intro music was playing, I refreshed the North Carolina State dashboard, and we have another new high today. So our trends are definitely going in the wrong direction.
What's happening?
Too many people are out and about, mingling with each other in indoor spaces, and we have a lot of community transmission happening. This doesn't seem to be associated with one particular event like universities reopening or coming post a holiday weekend. It's really kind of statewide and broadly happening.
Right. It's just, I mean, maybe even we think about the fatigue and people are just getting out more and more. A few more things, a lot more is open than the initial shutdown. And so, yeah, people are getting together and it isn't over. What about the treatments for people who are infected? Are we seeing some improvement there? Can we say anything about death rates with respect to case increases?
We're seeing a little bit of improvement in terms of having treatments that are available. Remdesivir and monoclonal antibodies were obviously just in the news a lot with President Trump being infected, as well as dexamethasone. However, not all of those treatments are approved and broadly available yet, and they have pretty limited windows of efficacy where someone needs to be treated early for these drugs to have an impact, and that's not widely available for everyone. We have very limited quantities of some of these medicines. I think our death rate is looking a little bit better right now because we have more younger people getting infected who are less likely to pass away. But also, our hospitals had been a bit emptier, which allows for better care. But most importantly, we know that hospitalization and mortality are lagging indicators. So in a few weeks or in a month, those fatality rates are going to look higher again, and that's because of the people who are becoming infected today.
All right. Well, let's talk about vaccination. This week, researchers put two high-profile late-stage clinical trials on pause. Last month, AstraZeneca paused its vaccine trial. What does this mean for the race for better treatments and a vaccine?
So while this seems worrisome, it's actually really expected. So when everyone was kind of wishing or politicians were saying we'll have something by the end of October, by November, before the election, a lot of people in the field said that is incredibly wishful thinking. Everything would have to go perfectly, and that's just not what happens in the real world and definitely not what happens in 2020. So normally, these types of events that cause a pause in a phase three clinical trial happen, and they're just under the radar. The company's aware of it. Their investors might be aware of it. But these normally take place over the course of years while something is in the developmental pipeline, and the public just wouldn't be paying attention, have this laser beam focus on what's happening with a clinical trial the way everyone does right now, because this is such a novel and extreme situation. So it's worrisome. We definitely want to see these pauses be resolved. Hopefully, there aren't any major safety issues and the companies are able to resume enrollment and complete the trials. But it's not completely out of the ordinary. It's not a huge red flag right now.
And, it also, I think implicitly, the good news is there is a system that's ensuring our safety for all of this. Putting something in your arm isn't the thing that's going to make you well. Putting something safe and effective in your arm, and this suggests that the efficacy and safety are still important to people doing the research.
Absolutely. That is such a great point, that we're seeing pretty outstanding transparency from the pharmaceutical companies, and that they are following the due process and being as careful as possible, because it's hugely important for them as successful companies and as people really doing their best to fight this pandemic and help society. and for all of us that these vaccines be safe and efficacious. And if we can't trust the vaccine, no one is going to take it. Luckily, they're recognizing that, and it seems like doing the right thing.
What about a vaccine and the research? Are you optimistic about the research and about our ability to find a vaccine?
I am optimistic. The results that we've seen posted from phase one and phase two trials seem very promising. Obviously, those are with much smaller cohorts of patients, though. So the phase three trials are really where it's at. We need to see these tens of thousands of patients, how they do, you know, handling the dosage. And do we see that these people are, in fact, protected from becoming infected or protected from developing severe disease?
Efficacy is a very important program. I'm part of this project, I guess, because, we know year after year for seasonal flu, efficacy rates for flu vaccines, as I say, for seasonal flu have varied. What can we expect for coronavirus? Is it substantially different, or that's still a concern, I guess, right? Will it be effective?
It's always going to be a little bit of a concern, but coronaviruses are much more stable than flu is. Just because of the genome and some enzymes that it encodes, they don't mutate as readily. So we don't see the type of genetic diversity in SARS-2 that we see in flu. We don't have all these different strains circulating. So at least initially, we should have a very good match for what people might be infected with. And I think that gives us a good shot for a highly efficacious vaccine.
Your lab specializes in coronavirus. What have you been working on?
What haven't we been working on, I think, is a bigger question. We've been doing all sorts of work looking at, some of these second-generation vaccines that might be coming online later that are a little bit more targeted or specialized. We're doing a lot of testing of monoclonal antibodies. We've looked into the D614G spike mutation that's gotten a lot of attention as one of the main variants that's popped up and is a little bit different from the sequences that came out of Wuhan initially that people based these vaccines on. And we don't see any issue with a change in ability to recognize that virus and protect from infection. So we're working really hard and hoping that what we're doing can make a difference.
Well, here's where I ask you all the questions about what should we be doing now. And I'm going to start with you because I understand that you are taking a well-earned vacation soon. So how are you planning to spend that?
My husband and I are renting a van and following, all of our favorite YouTube and Instagram people that we watch to try and relax in the evening. And we are going to be taking as self-contained a little road trip as we can. Our initial plan was to head out to the Midwest. We might be rethinking our location just because there's so much virus there right now, but we are bringing as many supplies as we can, and we will be spending our time outside in national forests and away from other people.
Well, I'm glad to hear you're taking a small break, and then when you go back, you'll go back fresh. And what should we all be doing? Because now the colder temperatures, people have been getting together but able to social distance outside. What's going to happen to us when it gets cold?
This is going to be really difficult and hard for all of us. And unfortunately, the answer isn't one that, I like to admit to myself, that I like to share with other people. But we're really going to need to batten down and narrow our personal bubbles, our circles, and be as careful as possible. And that's especially if people are thinking about wanting to get together with family that they haven't seen over the holidays. I think it's really important that people be very aware of what their contacts are, how many people they're seeing, try and minimize, indoor close contacts as much as possible, and have a small bubble of people who have a similar risk as you, who have similar risks that they're willing to take for themselves. Maybe you all work from home, you have kids who are currently being homeschooled, and you have one other family that you're comfortable getting together with because they have the same kind of precautions in mind as you.
And that's going to make, I'm just thinking about the holidays and how you draw up that list and what you do for those holiday meals.
Yeah, that's a really tough one because when we all think about, maybe getting together with family for Thanksgiving, it's not about waving to someone outside while you're wearing a mask. It's about sitting next to your aunts and uncles, your cousins, your grandparents, your parents at a big table indoors, sharing a meal together. And if that's really critical for you and important for your mental health going into these winter months that are going to be more challenging, I think it's really important that people restrict their contacts as much as possible for the couple of weeks beforehand, really 2-3 weeks beforehand, start minimizing your trips outside of the house, see as few people as possible so that you can be confident in your health and your safety when you go and see your family members. And they need to do the same thing.
You know, this leads to one quick last question, which is about testing with regard to quarantine, because I know people are getting like frequent tests in, you know, to kind of assure that they're safe to see other people, right? That's the idea. But I'm guessing if you're not quarantining in between, I don't know, tell me about frequent testing and how effective that can be.
Well, I think we saw how good frequent testing is and isn't with the recent White House outbreak. Testing gives you information about that single point in time, and if you're not taking other preventative measures like social distancing, like wearing a mask, like having kind of a log of what people you see and who you stay clear of, then you're still at very high risk. All frequent testing tells you is whether or not you were infected at that point in time. It doesn't mean that you don't have a subclinical infection brewing, that you're about to be infected, that you could be contagious. So it's good information, but it's limited information.
Lisa Grilinski, assistant professor in the Department of Epidemiology at UNC Chapel Hill. Have a safe trip, Lisa, and thank you for talking with us.
Thank you.
You can find out more about her work and everything we talk about at our website, stateofthings.org. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.